In the matter of State versus Laura Gonzalez, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Margaret McLean, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Ms. Gonzalez.
Lauren Gottesman, on behalf of the Innocence Project, in support of Ms. Gonzalez.
Joseph Hayden from the Pashman-Stein firm, on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Deputy Attorney General Stephen K. Cattanaro, on behalf of the state.
Thank you, counsel. I have Mr. Hayden going before
Ms. Gottesman. Is that consistent with?
That's fine.
Excellent.
Let's start with Ms. McLean. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve just a few minutes for rebuttal if it's necessary.
That's fine.
And I'd like to start with the invocation issue and then do the expert testimony issue. So turning to the invocation issue, as Miranda itself recognizes, custodial interrogations are inherently coercive. And so our law puts into place protections to minimize that coercion. One of the most important of these protections is a defendant's right to counsel and the corresponding need to scrupulously honor any invocation of that right. Here, those protections were rendered entirely meaningless. Laura Gonzalez was vulnerable and afraid in a police-dominated environment. She was undocumented, she did not speak English very well, and she had no familiarity with the U.S. criminal justice system. She'd been intercepted when she arrived at work that morning by two detectives, asked to come to a police station, and then questioned by a detective who simply would not believe her when she maintained she did not intentionally hurt anyone. Under these circumstances, Gonzalez did the best she could. She asked the only person available to her, the interrogating detective, for a lawyer. She said, "But now what do I do about an attorney and everything?" In the face of this request, the detective did not do what our law requires when someone is or might be invoking her right to counsel. The detective did not clarify what Gonzalez wanted. She did not explain that Gonzalez had the right to a lawyer, that if she wanted a lawyer, they would stop the questioning until a lawyer got in the room with her. And most importantly, she did not ask Gonzalez if she wanted a lawyer. Instead, the detective refused to answer Gonzalez's question, sidestepping it in a way that discouraged her from trying to assert her rights again or more clearly, and instead continued into this coercive interrogation by contradicting the Miranda warnings. To condone these kinds of interrogation tactics will allow police and the state to play games with people's fundamental rights. It will require people to persistently and clearly invoke the right to counsel, notwithstanding this court's longstanding recognition that that's not what we do in New Jersey. In New Jersey, unlike under federal law, quote, any indication of a desire for counsel, however ambiguous, will trigger entitlement to counsel, as this court said in Reed. And if someone's statements are so ambiguous that they cannot be understood to be the assertion of the right of a right, clarification is not only permitted, but needed, as this court said in Alston. So here, when Gonzalez asked about a lawyer, the interrogating detective had two options. She could stop the interrogation completely, or she could briefly pause the interrogation to clarify, remind Gonzalez that she has a right to a lawyer, and ask her if she wants to exercise that right. Ask her if she wants a lawyer. The detective's failure to do this requires that Gonzalez's statement be suppressed. This court should reverse the appellate division, suppress the statement, and reverse Gonzalez's convictions. I didn't request an opening, but that concludes the opening if I
please have go ahead. One. Go ahead with your
Again, just to reiterate, the ruling, this court has set up a universe in New Jersey where there's going, because any indication of a desire for counsel, however ambiguous, is going to require, has to be honored, there's a pretty broad universe of circumstances where police are going to have to pause the interrogation and ask questions. And this isn't a burden on police. It's good, this stop and clarify approach is really good for everyone. It obviously protects a defendant's fundamental right to counsel by giving them the time and the space to ask for counsel if they really do
want it. Ms. McLean, I don't know if you're concerned about this, But isn't there an additional problem? Because the interrogating detective was saying the truth sets everything free. It's better to tell the truth. And that directly contradicts the earlier warning that anything that you may say will be used against you. And we have specifically said, as recently as in LH, that police officers who are interrogating suspects, such as your client, cannot use that tactic. That is prohibited. Go ahead.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the detective does this throughout the interrogation, specifically contradicts the warnings by talking about how it will be better if you tell the truth. But she, as the detective did in LA, she literally says the truth will set you free. She at one point mentions the prosecutor and the, how the defendant's going to need consideration from the prosecutor. And as it applies to the invocation, this contradiction of Miranda warnings is particularly insidious because the defendant had been trying to, had been talking for over an hour, and then she does the only thing that's left to her and invokes her rights.
And it's not just the right to an attorney. She was told she had a right to an appointed attorney.
Yes.
This was not a person who would have the means to get her own attorney. So when she says, you're going to help me with an attorney, that seems to be like directly in relationship to the warning much earlier that, you know, you have a right to an appointed attorney. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And she was doing the best she can. She was trying to follow the what she was told her rights were. She was trying to get this lawyer in the room because the detective doesn't believe her when she's explaining what happened. And the detective, rather than answering that question, treating this for what it was, an invocation, instead contradicts the Miranda warnings and said, it's better to tell the truth, notwithstanding everything I told you before about how these statements are going to be used against you. It's better to tell the truth. And that renders, you know, that they ignored her invocation, and on top of it, it raises serious questions about the voluntariness of the overall statement. And voluntariness is important for a lot of reasons, but one of them is because involuntary statements are inherently untrustworthy. Forced confessions tend to be false confessions. And where someone is denying knowing what happened, trying to offer an explanation, and then is not being believed and tries to invoke her right and is rebuffed, then what comes out later is not reliable. It's not not the kind of evidence that our legal system.
The detective was also minimizing the charges and the nature of what she was up against by saying, you're not in trouble at this moment, and making comments like that repeatedly. Am I correct?
You are correct. She minimizes the conduct. She talks about how the family's not looking to, I think at one point she says, the family's not looking to prosecute you. You're not in trouble. It's better to tell the truth. If you don't talk, you can dig yourself into this hole. So really throughout, she's engaging in these impermissibly coercive interrogation tactics that this court has recognized over and over again, and most recently in LH, are the kind of thing that police cannot do, that does not produce an admissible statement.
So Ms. McLean, page 123 into 124, I know you were talking about an earlier part of the transcript. The defendant, you know, appears to be, you know, again, returning to asking for help from her interrogator, who also is speaking to her in Spanish. And am I correct? Is she the one who did the transcript of this?
Yes, that is my understanding. Because the statement occurs in both Spanish and English, the detective went through and translated the Spanish portions into English.
So she's an interrogator, and she's also doing the interpreting of the Spanish choice of word to the English choice of word that appears in this transcript, correct?
Yes, as that's my understanding, yes.
Because there were a number of unusual phraseologies in here. But anyway, to focus on page 123 to 124, we have again the what appears to be the misunderstanding of the defendant to the role being played by her interlocutor. You're going to help me with an attorney, which is a bit like what appeared on, I guess it was earlier, page 97, but it shows itself in much more full bloom at 123, 124. And instead of clarifying at that point, she's telling her, you're not helping yourself by not continuing with the interrogation. Does this transcript bear any resemblance to State versus Alston, where we had a different view of the kind of exchange that was going on between somebody who was making what appeared to be, what was argued to be an ambiguous request, and we were not persuaded of that, and what happened here for your client?
No, and so Alston was really a case, Alston was really a case about the scope of clarification and what clarification looks like. And in Alston, the defendant asked a question, should I not have a lawyer? The police recognized that's an ambiguous something. He at least is asking this question about a critically important right. And so they do the right thing. They stop the interrogation. They specifically ask him, you want a lawyer? When he gives a wishy-washy response, they provide more detail. You have the right to a lawyer. If you want a lawyer, we'll stop questioning you until you have a lawyer. And then they ask him again, do you want a lawyer? And it's only after he responds negative, he responds no to that, that he reaffirms that.
Question, counsel, based on Justice Lavecchia's question, did you have someone at your office that speaks Spanish translate the interrogation?
I did not, because there was no challenge below to the.
I was just wondering if there were any inconsistencies that person found.
I don't speak Spanish, and I have not had anyone in my office, or we haven't hired a formal translator to translate.
Well, the reason I asked that question.
I didn't ask the reason. I just wanted to find out. I speak
actually,
Spanish.
You can help me.
I speak Spanish, and I found no inconsistency. I just want to know if someone at their office found any inconsistency.
At some point in the transcript, she says, I'm blocked. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean she's immobilized? Is she forgetting something? Can she not remember something?
Well, there could have been a question asking an explanation, but as far as with the translation, I found it to be word for word. That's why I asked if someone had found something different.
But on page one, going back, Ms. McLean, to page 123, 124, there doesn't seem to be any lack of clarity in the questions that were being asked of the interrogator. And there doesn't seem to be a clear response back to the defendant to help her understand her rights and clarify whether she wishes to assert them.
That's a whole different issue. I just wonder if someone found inconsistencies.
To Justice Fernandez's question, no. And to Justice Lavecchia's question, unlike Alston, where the police specifically addressed the question by saying, do you want a lawyer? Here, the officer does not do that. At best, she ignores the question, but she immediately transitions into this contradiction of Miranda warnings of, you're not helping. Unless you give me a quote unquote truth that I believe, i.e. a full confession, which is what the detective was going for, she's not going to respect her rights, she's not going to help her, and Ms. Gonzalez is not getting out of this interrogation room until she gives the detective what she wants, which is a full confession, whether or not that is the truth.
In Alston really suggests precisely what should have been done here, because Detective Muhammad said, if you want to, when the issue was raised, if you want a lawyer, then we stop and you're going to get your lawyer. That's why we had read that clearly to you and your waiver. If you want to stop at this time, then we stop at this time. It's either yes or no. And it goes on like that. That was what was required when there was any ambiguity. Do you want a lawyer? If you want a lawyer, we stop questioning. Correct?
Yes, absolutely. Alston really shows what appropriate clarification looks like. It requires asking, do you want a lawyer? If that answer is wishy-washy, if there's still a question, then they have to provide more detail. And it's only when they get this clear indication from the defendant that he understands his rights and wants to keep speaking without an attorney present that the interrogation could then continue. And that's why this court's holding in Alston, which the trial court seemed to mis- construe a bit, this court's holding in Alston was not that a question is not an ambiguous invocation. It was that this defendant's question, when clarified by police, was not an invocation. But the only way this court could know that, and the only way a reviewing court can ever know that, is when the police clarify, when they specifically ask, do you want a lawyer? You asked a question about a lawyer. You have the right to a lawyer. Do you want one now? And that's the opposite of what happened here. The detective ignored her question and instead pressured her to continue speaking by contradicting the Miranda warnings.
Do you challenge the part of the statement that precedes her use of the term, you know, attorney, lawyer, you're going to get me a lawyer? Did you challenge the part of the statement preceding that?
It was not the question this court granted on. This court granted on whether she invoked her rights. So for purposes of this appeal, I'm not challenging the things that happened before the invocation. I'm not saying that if this gets remanded, there might not be an additional a Miranda motion where the voluntariness, the waiver itself, could be challenged. But for purposes of this appeal, it's after page 97 where she says, but what do I do about an attorney?
Was the motion made before the trial court? Did that motion challenge that portion of the statement?
The before the trial court, as here, the focus really was on the invocation.
So my question is, was the first part of the statement challenged?
No, it wasn't. The first part of the statement was not challenged.
So that not only is not before us, but it wasn't before the trial court or the appellate division.
Well, the state always bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that a statement is, that a waiver is knowing and voluntary, that a statement is
admissible. That was never challenged except as to the second part of the statement.
Yes, I don't mean to nitpick. No, but yes, it was not challenged.
Okay.
I think we have your argument. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I again just ask this court to reaffirm Alston, reaffirm this court's longstanding jurisprudence that any indication, however ambiguous, of a desire for counsel requires the stop and clarify approach. Turning to the issue with the expert testimony, the issues for the jury here to decide boil down to basically two things. Was this an accident or not an accident? And was it the parents or Gonzalez? And in trying to prove its case, the state improperly used the sole expert witness to testify to put a thumb firmly on the scale of a non-accidental injury caused by Gonzalez. And this was inappropriate, unhelpful, ultimate issue testimony that was highly prejudicial and clearly capable of producing an unjust result. And this is not to say that there's no place for expert testimony in this case. As a medical doctor, as a pediatrician, the expert here was allowed to, and testimony would have been very helpful on these points of the kinds of injuries the child had, the types of force needed to cause those injuries, and the variety of ways those injuries could occur, both intentionally and accidentally.
Would the expert testify with a reasonable degree of scientific or medical probability that had the injuries were caused, that the mechanics of the injury, would that be all right? In other words, this injury happened from a fall or a twisting of the leg or a twisting of the arm, or would that be within the expert's realm of expertise, a medical doctor?
She could testify as to whether a particular mechanism, a particular action is consistent or inconsistent with the kind of injuries. Could you get a spiral fracture?
Is it the standard reasonable degree of medical probability? Could an orthopedic surgeon testify the fracture of the tibia shows a twisting motion as consistent with someone twisting the foot? Not necessarily the defendant, but someone twisting the foot, someone with greater strength than a child or something like that. Wouldn't that be within the realm of an expert's opinion testimony?
Yes, insofar as Dr. Medina was familiar with how children of this child's age tend to get spiral fractures, the kinds of actions, both accidental and intentional, that cause these kinds of injuries, she could testify about those potential mechanisms of injury. Right. But what she couldn't do is what she did here, which is say, when the prosecutor asked her, This is 6T, page 29. Based on your training and experience, within a reasonable degree of medical certainty, do you have an opinion as to what caused the spiral fracture? And the expert responds, the only mechanism of trauma that was reported on the records I reviewed was provided by the other caregiver who was the nanny in the house. And so in other words, Dr. Medina is saying the only thing that could explain what happened here is that Gonzalez did it.
She was referring back to Gonzalez. She was given Gonzalez's statement. But putting that aside for a second, not just the expert, but the mother testified in a way more damaging than the expert. Now, I'm just going to quote. This is coming from the mother. Quote, they said, referring to the doctors, they said the way it was done was intentional. There's no way this is an accident. And like 99% of the cases of this was intentional abuse. And that was permitted in. And there was an objection. And the judge said that that was coming in not for the truth of the matter asserted.
Yes. Mom's testimony, repeating what these doctors said, was much, much more explicit than what Dr. Medina did. It was much more explicit. She left no question that this was child abuse, that everyone agrees.
And that was totally inadmissible. There's no grounds for that.
As the appellate division said, that was entirely inadmissible. It was not a statement from, it was inadmissible hearsay. It's incredibly prejudicial and it should not have come in front of the jury at all. I also want to, returning briefly to Dr. Medina's testimony, embedded in her opinion that the only mechanism of trauma that could explain this is this implicit credibility determination. She's saying, I've reviewed essentially the same evidence the jury's reviewing. I've reviewed mom, dad, and Gonzalez and the child's injuries. And I believe, and she concludes, because Gonzalez is the only explanation, therefore, mom and dad must not have done it. Mom and dad must be credible when they're denying knowing what happened. And this court has repeatedly maintained that experts can't offer their opinions on credibility determinations or can't make credibility determinations. That's the sole province of the jury. So to sum up here, there's obviously, briefly to return to your question, Justice Albin, about what Dr. Medina actually reviewed. She reviewed Gonzalez's statement filtered through first the detective and then the DCPMP report. So she didn't even see the transcript itself. So she's relying on, you know, a game of telephone to make these determinations. But either way, what comes out is this impermissible opinion on the defendant's guilt. She says, The only conclusion that the jury could draw from her testimony is that this was non-accidental, so it was intentional, and that Gonzalez is the only plausible explanation. And this kind of ultimate issue testimony about a defendant's guilt is highly prejudicial because it allows the jury to rely on the expert's judgment, the expert's apparent expertise, rather than their own assessment of these facts that were before them. And so if for either or both these reasons, either for the need to suppress Gonzalez's statement or for the improper admission of testimony about how this is clearly child abuse and that Gonzalez did it, Ms. Gonzalez's convictions must be reversed.
Thank you, Ms. McClain. Mr. Hayden.
Good afternoon. This case involves two requests by a woman for counsel during a custodial interrogation, which was very aggressive, and this woman had no prior exposure to the criminal justice system. She, at the outset, was given three Miranda warnings, three of the five, which pertain to the right to counsel, which she had available to her at any time. And the language of that right said, at any time. And when she raised the issue of counsel, the interrogating officer really blew her off and told her best option was to keep answering questions to help ourselves. As has been mentioned, we know New Jersey case law has been very protective of the right to counsel in the Miranda situation. and the ambiguous requests, any minor requests, equivocal requests are viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant. And more importantly, the burden of proof of waiver is on the state both at the outset and during any continuous interrogation if there's a Miranda issue. Now, what happened here is the appellate division misinterpreted the ambiguous or equivocal requests and said they were requests for advice as to whether or not to have an attorney. And I suggest to you, if we look at the transcript, and Justice LaVecchia started to deal with that, what the requests really are is a request for help as to how to get an attorney. Just to go over the custodial interrogation, this woman is scooped up, brought to the prosecutor's office. She says, first of all, in the transcript, I'm in shock. And then she says, what is this about? And they tell her, well, we can't really tell you what it's about till after we advise you of your rights and give us permission to talk. What rule of law says that the police don't have to tell somebody what the interrogation is about before they ask them to weigh? But the investigator blew by that. Then ultimately, they said to her, before the waiver, you're not in any trouble. You're not in any trouble. We just want to have a conversation. And so just bear with me a second. Sometimes as lawyers, maybe judges, we go over these rights too fast. Let's look at the relevant language of the Miranda right to counsel. First, they say you have a right to speak with an attorney at any time and have him or her with you before and during the question. A little later, okay, if you cannot afford to hire an attorney, but want one, an attorney will be provided at no cost prior to questioning. Do you understand? Third point, you have a right to stop answering questions or speak with an attorney at any time during the questioning. So this unschooled woman in the criminal justice system, she's scared, but she's hearing, attorney, attorney, attorney. You're having a right to attorney at any time. It's bouncing off, and this informs what happens later, in my opinion. Then the interrogation starts, and they ask her early on, are you here legally? She says, no, I'm here illegally. You think maybe that had a chilling effect, that irrelevant question? They then indicate to her that they lie and say, we have videos, you better tell the truth because we have these videos and we're gonna find out what you did. And the video lie is told 3 or 4 times during the course of the question. Then they say, as they begin to tighten the screws, by the way, the family's not looking to prosecute here. They just wanna know what happened. I suspect that's a lie because this is a criminal investigation. She was arrested after this is over. The family's not looking to prosecute here. And then we come to the first request for a attorney. And it's deep into the questioning. The situation is going to not go any worse, Reyes says. And Gonzalez says, but now what do I do about an attorney and everything? As they're going from the general questions to the specific questions, and she's talking about her fear of jail. This woman who's heard attorney, attorney, attorney about 45 minutes ago now is asking about an attorney. And with that, the investigator, who was skilled at what she was doing, but she was way over the line, then begins to tell her, I can't give you an opinion on that, but you'll have a better option by telling the truth. A couple of lines down, she says, your better option is telling the truth. Because her theme is tell the truth, tell the truth. And as Justice Albin pointed out, that is contrary to Miranda. But the sell to this woman during the interrogation is, you tell the truth, you explain everything, nobody's gonna really do too much to you. And then the second, but I submit to you, when she said, but now what do I do about an attorney? She's asking for help. she's asking for, how do I get this? Because the weakness in the rights is they don't tell you the mechanics of, if you want an attorney, how you get an attorney and how the court does this appointment process. And this woman who's not involved with the system has no idea. But then as Justice Lavecchi pointed out, the second inquiry about 15 pages later, she comes back. You're going to help me with an attorney. She wanted help with an attorney. She didn't want an advice about whether to have an attorney. I'm going to help you with an attorney. She says, no. Gonzalez says, I don't know. I need you to guide me. I'm honest, I don't know. She doesn't need guidance on whether she has an attorney. This idea that there's an attorney out there, a court will appoint it, what'll stop, what won't stop. And at that point in time, it's clear she was asking for an attorney, asking for help by getting an attorney. And as was pointed out by in the Alston case, on page 618, there's like a list of about a Q&A of about 8 questions. And the most powerful question was the line was pointed out by Justice Albin, because when Alston says he may want a lawyer, the detective almost got mad at him. That's on you. If you want an attorney, then we stop and you're going to get your lawyer. That's why we read that clearly to you in your waiver. If you want to stop at this time, when we stop at this time, it's either yes or no. You're either in or out, buddy. And there's a few more questions back and forth. That's the way it's supposed to be done. This is what was not done here. There was lies about video. There was lies about you could help yourself. There's lies about the family's not going to prosecute to this woman who was in a form of shock. And I believe that the Miranda warnings and the right to counsel are particularly appropriate for a case like this. Because, to use a non-legal word, in my opinion, the facts were murky. Murky as to how the injuries really happened. Murky as to when the injuries really happened, murky as to exactly who it was that caused the injuries. Now you have this woman out of the blue, and you can see it in the transcript. She's trying to be compliant and give as much information as she can come up with, but she's guessing. She's guessing as to the time. Well, could have been this, could have been that. She, at the very end, she is trying to be more and more compliant because she thinks if she helps fill in the blanks, she's helping herself, not being aware of the dangers. And there's where somebody is very, very vulnerable to manipulation. And there's the great potential for an injustice where somebody guesses at an answer without reflecting and is wrong. But that happens a lot with people first time around in a stress situation. And that is the end. If there's any doubt, look what happened at the end. And I'm sorry, this offends me. At the very end, the investigator had her write a note to the family where she calls herself a monster. Talk about compliant. Talk about not having a lawyer available. I don't ever remember seeing that confession case where somebody writes a note to the family. But she is trying to be compliant because she feels bad. You know, it's been said, I think it was said in the prosecutor's brief, words matter. And I agree, words matter. The words of the Miranda rights matter. And beyond the spoken word, the unspoken words matter. And the unspoken words in this case are the questions not asked, the advice not given. And I submit that this case cries out to this court for a bright line rule. And the ACDLS, a bright line, if there's any invocation or reference to an attorney, all questioning must immediately stop. The suspect must be told that they either, you want an attorney, what do you mean by an attorney? Do you want questioning to continue before you have an attorney? And if the person says yes, something like Alston, then you go ahead. But you never want to have a suspicion where something's ambiguous and a great injustice could be done Thank you for giving me a little extra time.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden.
Ms. Gottesman?
Good afternoon. Lauren Gottesman on behalf of the Innocence Project. The analysis of hundreds of DNA exonerations across the nation have made it clear that false confessions elicited by coercive police interrogation is a leading cause of wrongful convictions. And while the Innocence Project does not take the position that Miranda and its ancillary rights function as a cure-all for false confessions, we do recognize that when Miranda rules are properly interpreted and followed, they have the potential to provide meaningful protections for those who find themselves, as Ms. Gonzalez did, physically isolated, confronted by detectives who presume and then insist upon their guilt, and are then subjected to coercive interrogation tactics that we know place innocent people at risk of false confession. Providing custodial subjects with a reasonable way to end this type of coercive interrogation is critical to help prevent false confessions, which, once uttered in the interrogation room, are difficult to detect and overwhelmingly prejudicial, and thus likely to result in a wrongful conviction. The analysis of proven false confessions have also clearly established that certain groups of people, for example, children and the cognitively impaired, are more likely than the average adult to wrongfully incriminate themselves in response to police coercion. And the same populations of people who are most at risk for false confession are largely the same group of people who are unlikely to fully grasp how their Miranda rights function in the context of a high-stress interrogation, and are therefore unlikely to assert their rights with precise language. Accordingly, honoring any reference to a lawyer, however ambiguous or tentative that it may be, honoring that as an invocation of the right to counsel is critical to protect the state's most vulnerable citizens. And if I may paraphrase the Connecticut Supreme Court in its 2019 Purcell decision, to fail to treat an ambiguous or tentative reference to counsel as an invocation of the right to counsel is like only giving life preservers to the strong swimmers on a boat and leaving those who can't swim or don't have strong athletic skills without a life vest. The rule that we're urging the court to adopt, that any reference to a lawyer during a custodial interrogation requires the police to end the interrogation unless and until it's made clear after clarifying questions that the accused is not invoking the right, is not a new rule. In State v. SS, this court explained with regard to invocation of the right to silence, that if the suspect makes an ambiguous or tentative indication that they do not wish to speak with officers, then police may not continue an interrogation, quote, unless the suspect makes clear that he is not invoking his right to remain silent. So the same manner in which officers are required by this court to be clear that a suspect is not invoking his right to remain silent when there's any ambiguity is essentially what we're asking for here, so that those most susceptible to false confession have a reasonable way to protect both their right to silence and right to counsel during interrogations, and thereby potentially preventing a tragic miscarriage of justice. So at bottom, we're asking the court to continue its long history of issuing scientifically sound rules that help protect its citizens from wrongful conviction. And with regard to the expert issue, if I may just briefly highlight how the risk that a coerced and potentially false confession may cause a wrongful conviction is compounded when a medical expert testifying for the state, like Dr. Medina here, points to disputed confession evidence as the only feasible explanation for the victim's injuries, and in so doing invades the province of the jury. So here, the state's expert pediatrician characterized statements made by Ms. Gonzalez after close to 3 hours into a highly coercive interrogation as the explanation, or as Ms. McLean quoted for the court, the quote, only mechanism of trauma in the record that was consistent with the child's injuries. And Ms. Gonzalez's statements, however, were made only after police employed various interrogation tactics considered by experts to be risk factors for false confessions. The detectives here actually engaged in one of the most controversial tactics that has been referenced here already today, called the false evidence ploy. And all that means is that the detective here knowingly lied to Ms. Gonzalez repeatedly about evidence that didn't exist. They falsely told her that there was objective video evidence that proved she was lying when she asserted her innocence, and also deceptively told her that a confession would set her free. Such deceptive tactics are found in a vast number of proven false confession cases and should cause the court some pause with regard to the assessment of the reliability of this confession evidence. And with regard to the expert, the concern is that, as here, when experts point to unreliable evidence, like a confession extracted by deception, as a basis from which to draw a medical opinion about the likely cause of the victim's injury, and that opinion is presented to the jury as expert and thus scientifically sound, the risk is not just of invasion of the province of the jury by effectively having the expert weigh in on credibility of this disputed evidence, but also there's a risk that the expert is misleading the jury and potentially convicting an innocent person. This court and the United States Supreme Court has acknowledged that expert testimony can have a profound influence on the deliberations of the jury and indeed can mislead juries. So our position is that the problem is that physicians like Dr. Medina, who are experts in clinical diagnosis and treating victims, when they venture beyond this diagnostic testimony into this realm of etiology and do that not based on a scientific methodology, but rather using disputed and potentially unreliable evidence like this confession, that it has significant risks to mislead the jury and lead to wrongful conviction. So here we would urge the court to find that the testimony, like Dr. Medina's, goes too far. It went beyond diagnosis and treatment of injuries and went too close to expressing an opinion regarding guilt of the accused, all based primarily upon unreliable confession evidence. And if there's no questions, I will just thank the court for allowing the Innocence Project to participate in argument and for consideration of our brief. Thank you,
counsel. Mm-hmm. Mr. Cadenara.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. This case is about many things, but it's not about a request for counsel. It's about the totality of the circumstances, because this analysis has never been reduced to the utterance of a single magic word. It has always been about more. It's been about a defendant's tone and a defendant's inflection in order to ascertain exactly what the defendant meant. And when a defendant's words are taken together with the totality of the circumstances, it's clear that she asked for guidance and advice, not an attorney. The state will briefly address both of her statements. Regarding defendant's first statement, she asked, "But now what do I do about an attorney?" But those words indicate a desire for counsel. In fact, per the detective, her words should be interpreted as, "What do I do now?" When taken together with both her incriminating statements and her focus on the future, the totality of the circumstances, it's clear that defendant wanted to know what to do about an attorney going forwards, not what to do in that moment. Defendant's second statement is even plainer, as was her clarification in response to Reyes's question, "What you want to do?" In response to this clear attempt at clarification of her words, had defendant wanted one, she would have asked for an attorney, but she didn't. Instead, she asked Reyes for exactly what she wanted, for exactly what she'd already asked for several times, guidance and advice. And defendant confirmed as much at trial when she testified that she had in fact asked Reyes to be her advisor. But even if Reyes could have done more, that would not warrant reversal. The defendant abused a baby who was just over 6 months old. She broke his leg 3 times. And long before she made either of these statements, she admitted that she had shaken this baby with a lot of anger to stop his crying. That admission amply supports defendant's convictions for endangering and simple assault. And that, as Your Honors indicated, was admissible regardless of the defendant's comments. It was never contested. As such, error, if any, was harmless. To briefly address defendant's second point, Dr. Gladabel Medina, the state's expert witness, testified. And neither defendant nor amicus curiae can change what she said. They can't change the fact that she never testified that defendant was guilty or that these injuries were intentional. She testified that Tommy's injuries were consistent with non-accidental trauma and the conduct described by defendant. And Medina didn't bolster the testimony of either Seth or Lisa. Her words have meaning, and she related nothing more than a simple fact, that in her experience, caretakers, be they babysitter, parent, or grandparent, report accidental injury. Because no one reported anything, these injuries were not accidental. That was her testimony. Your Honors, this case is about many things, but when the totality of the circumstances are considered, it is not about a request for counsel. And when Medina's words are considered, it is clear that it's not about improper expert testimony. This concludes my opening statement.
Counselor, are you suggesting to us that after she was told she could have an attorney, she said, well, how do I go about getting an attorney? Do you get me one? That's not an implicit request for counsel, express probably, but implicit. What do you think that meant?
So, Your Honor,
do I look in the defendant's yellow pages or I go to, what do you think that meant? She's told you have a right to an attorney. She says, well, how do I go about getting that attorney and everything and for everything like that? You really think that's not a request for counsel?
Well, her actual words are, but now what do I do about an attorney and everything? And when the totality of the circumstances are considered,
totality,
it's clear that
you don't think that that's a clear request for counsel. What do I do about counsel using the exact words? I don't have them in front of me.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't. The defendant had just recently, within I think it was 10 or 15 transcript pages, made her incriminating statements. She had incriminated herself. And it's clear, but now going off of what the detective affirmatively testifies to, that indicates what do I do in the future and not what do I do in this moment. It's clear that she's asking what to do now that she has incriminated herself.
That's clear.
She's asking what to do going forward.
What are you basing that on, counsel? I know that's what you're arguing, that it's clear that defendant was asking for counsel going forward, but what is the totality of the circumstances that you are basing that assertion that it is obvious that she's looking for counsel in the future? And at minimum, why, after she asked that question, wasn't the detective obligated to at least clarify what she meant? I'm not seeing the clarity that you're seeing, that she was obviously seeking a counsel for the future. Why, you know, where, what are you basing that on? And why was the detective not obligated, based on our case law, at minimum to clarify what it was that she wanted? Because she, with the question, but now what do I do and everything, that also indicates that defendant lacked an understanding of how to go about obtaining an attorney.
Well, so I just want to clarify one thing very quickly, Your Honor. As the judge found as a factual finding, the defendant was informed of her rights and understood her rights, and she asked numerous questions to those effect, and the officer correctly answered those questions at the beginning of the interview. Now, as to why there was no duty to clarify, this court's case law is well settled. There is no duty to clarify unless it arguably amounts to an invocation. Where the words a defendant uses do not arguably amount to an invocation, there is no duty to clarify.
So a little bit over an hour into the interview, at this point on page 97, she says, but now what do I do about an attorney and everything? And that is not ambiguously stating some sort of invocation, questioning about her right to have counsel?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. And to answer the first part of Your Honor's last question, I think that might give a little clarity. Per Reyes's express testimony, and this is 1T34-14-22, now in the statement, now does not mean what now means in English. That's just an expression, like, what do I do? What do I do now? Not meaning at that very moment. It just means, you know, what do I do in the future? So Reyes's precise testimony, which the judge found credible, is that it is something in the future. It is not something
you can't, counsel,
in the present.
You can't take that. That's one comment that may in itself be an indication. But on page 123, you're going to help me with an attorney. She says, you're going to help me with an attorney. And I'm raising that because you have the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a waiver. Our jurisprudence says that these requests are supposed to be looked in light most favorable to the suspect. And this is a point that Mr. Hayden made. The defendant, the suspect, is told you have right to an attorney, you have right to an appointed attorney. There's no attorney there. Not even an educated person would know how that is going to work, because the only remedy really is to tell them, if you want an attorney, we'll stop talking to you. And none of that happened. So I want you to address the points that I'm raising to you in terms of the burden of proof, looking at it in the light most favorable. The initial warnings don't say that if you request an attorney, we're going to stop talking to you. And that's what the clarification should be. No? Go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, taking it in turn, and please correct me if I miss any points, because I would very much like to completely answer your question. The state has never heard from the burden in this case. We put up a witness to testify exclusively to this. We proffered the judge the statement, and based on all of the information in the record, a complete video recording of it showing the defendant's precise tone and inflection, as well as the officer's testimony to it, both as in terms of the process of the translation, as well as the mechanics of what happened, as well as what got lost in translation, that's a substantial body of evidence for the judge to consider. Now, as for the light most favorable, an arguable invocation must be interpreted in light most favorable to the defendant. But based on what the defendant said immediately following the statement Your Honor referenced, she only wanted guidance and advice. She did not want an attorney. And she makes that abundantly clear. When Reyes asked, what do you want to do, specifically in response to the defendant's statement, the defendant answers. She wanted guidance and advice. And had she wanted an attorney, she would have said it there when Reyes specifically asked.
Well, counsel, are you referring to page 123 to 124?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
So the way I read it, I'm not exactly sure if Reyes is asking her a question. She said, defendant says, you're going to help me with an attorney. Reyes says, I'm going to help you with an attorney, or no. Oh no, that is your decision, what you want to do. And defendant says, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, even there, Reyes says, that is your decision, what you want to do. Now, even the detective's statement in that moment is acknowledging the fact that defendant is making a statement with regard to possibly what is going to happen with her getting an attorney. Why at that moment was Reyes not obligated to clarify, well, do you want to get an attorney? She's not asking her a question there. And Reyes is the one that did this transcript. There's no question mark there. She's not asking her. It doesn't seem like she's asking her a question. She's saying that's your decision, what you want to do, as opposed to if you want an attorney can be appointed for you and we will stop talking.
I mean, Your Honor, I would argue that the phrase what you want to do in itself indicates to anyone hearing it, well, if you want something, you're asking me, what do you want me to do, right? There might not be a question mark in that at the end of that sentence, but the words themselves are indicative of a question.
And the person who made the statement did this transcript and didn't put a question mark at the end of it. It doesn't appear she was asking her a question.
Well, I would also direct Your Honor to the immediately preceding section. I'm going to help you with an attorney, question mark. She hears what the defendant says and then asks, I'm going to help you with an attorney? No. The defendant says yes. And Reyes correctly says, that's your decision. What do you want to do? And then
Mr. Cuninara, can I ask you to focus on some of the language on page 123 that comes a little bit earlier? Because I think context matters, and I hope you can help here. I'm going to start just below the middle of the page where the detective says, this is your time now.
This is your time now to tell the truth. Okay. And like I said, giving it to me little piece by little piece, is giving me more reinforcement. And I'd ask that you please pay careful attention now to what follows. More reinforcement to know that you want to talk, but you are afraid. And then the defendant says, yes, it's because you haven't, and then it says inaudible. And the detective goes on to ask for clarification and says, no, what?
What? And that's when defendant says, you're going to help me
with an attorney. What was it that the defendant was accusing the detective of not having done when she said, yes, it's because you haven't inaudible.
Respectfully, Your Honor, it's very difficult sitting here to be able to answer that question. As this was brought up extensively during cross-examination, and the judge actually addressed it briefly, and the court noted that there was mutual effort at that time where the detective and defendant would speak at the same time. But, and this is very, very important, the court specifically notes that it did not appear as if the detective was attempting to cut off any answer at any time. So
not suggesting a deliberate effort to cut off.
I'm asking from the context what it is that it appears the defendant was accusing the detective of not having done.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I just don't know. It is inaudible. It's very difficult to hear that section. And unfortunately, I do not speak Spanish. So that section of the transcript is something that I am not able to give you a precise answer on.
Is it reasonable to think that perhaps the defendant was saying, I'm not going to talk because you haven't helped me with an attorney?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. It is a totality of the circumstances analysis, and one thing is very clear from this transcript. The defendant wanted to talk. She viewed Reyes as a friend. She never invoked her right to
speak. So if I could, let's stay just with this area here, these few passages that I'm struggling with. Does the context suggest, at the very least, that there's ambiguity with respect to an assertion of the right to counsel?
Well, I would direct Your Honor to the inflection and tone in that section of the video.
I've listened to it.
Okay. From my recollection, that section of the video was not very tense. It was not very, there wasn't exactly any indication from the defendant's body language, which remained relaxed and open.
So let's focus on the words, though, because tension cuts both ways. The absence of tension doesn't mean that there wasn't a request for counsel. It's the juxtaposition of an accusation, you haven't done something, it's inaudible, followed by, when asked for clarification, you're going to help me with an attorney. And my question is, from the context, does that suggest at the least some ambiguity?
Not ambiguity that isn't clarified when the defendant tells her, I need you to guide me, I'm honest, I don't know.
No, but it's not the defendant who should be clarifying. It's the detective, no?
It's the detective's duty to clarify an arguable invocation, but when the defendant's words don't indicate an arguable invocation, there is no duty to clarify. And again, Reyes did ask, what do you want to do? And the defendant did not either invoke her right to an attorney or her right to silence.
So I'll stop soon, but let me just ask you this. If it's reasonable to consider this an ambiguous invocation, the accusation coupled with the statement, what should the officer then have done?
Can you repeat that one more time, Your Honor? I apologize.
If one interprets this as an ambiguous invocation of the right to counsel, what was the proper response by the officer?
If this was interpreted as an ambiguous right to counsel, the proper course of action would be to clarify. But I would also point out that this court hasn't held at any point that the clarification needs to be a formulaic reinvocation.
Would you agree that we don't have that clarification in the ensuing lines that follow?
No, Your Honor, I don't. Again, defendant says you're going to help me with an attorney. The detective asks, I'm going to help you with an attorney, asking, what do you mean? She then says, that's your decision. What do you want to do? So respectfully, I would argue that had the defendant wanted an attorney, she would have requested one in response to that statement, and that was a clarification.
But I'm looking at the defendant, at the detective's words. What part of the detective's words constitute a clarification of the right to counsel?
So I would point, Your Honor, to the second to last line, I'm going to help you with an attorney, which is phrased as a question. I would also point, Your Honor, to the following lines, that's your decision, what do you want to do?
I understand your point.
Thank you, counsel.
And again, I would also note that we can't just analyze these words by themselves. We have to take into account the broader record, as well as what has been found to be ambiguous or not in the past. And it's the state's position that this is essentially indistinguishable from Alston or Messina, right? Whereas in Alston, the language is, should I not have a lawyer in here with me? And Messina is, do you think I need a lawyer? This is, you're going to help me with a lawyer, with an attorney. And the meaning there is, and those words are actually very, very close, much closer than Maglio or I believe the other case is Clark, which are referenced in Messina itself. Maglio being, maybe I should have an attorney, and Clark being, I had better talk to a lawyer. So there's a spectrum here, and this falls much far closer to Alston and Messina. It's not a declarative statement regarding the right to counsel. And the totality of the circumstances surrounding it do bring out exactly what she wanted, guidance and advice regarding what to do in the future.
I have just one question, which I touched on before. Assume for a minute that we conclude that this was at least an ambiguous invocation, that more needed to be done. There were a number of statements and admissions before we get to that point. If that is all that comes in, as it did at trial, is that sufficient to demonstrate, to convict? I guess, without the second part of the statement, are the admissions in the first part of the statement enough?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it is. It's worth noting exactly what she admitted in that first part of the statement, and this is DA 72. Detective, and you shook him and said, be quiet, defendant, yes. So she admits that she shook him, and subsequently, and I believe the site is DA 83 or 84, she admits that she shook him with a lot of anger, which, per Medina's testimony, would cause some of these injuries. That added with the motive regarding her troubled home life, which is in the first half of the statement, as well as what the parents testified to, along with her ample opportunity to conduct it, is strong evidence to support defendant's conviction for endangering and simple assault.
Did she admit to doing anything else? I thought there were some admissions, and I don't have all those statements in front of me right now, about grabbing the child by the legs or the arms.
Yes, Your Honor, there is. There's language that she pulled the child's leg.
And the doctor spoke about that as well, did she not?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes.
Her admission that she may have injured the child, does that come after?
No, Your Honor. I apologize.
After the passages that we've been asking you about?
No, Your Honor. The first reference to an attorney is on DA 96 and 97. These statements that we were just discussing were on DA 72 and DA 83 into 84, I believe.
The note certainly comes after, right?
Yes, the note does come after, Your Honor.
Which is quite damaging.
I mean, it's certainly a different case without it, but the fact remains that the evidence is there to support both of defendants' convictions based solely on this.
But that's not the standard. The standard is, if there was suppression, whether or not the statements that went in prejudiced the defendant's right to a fair trial. So the question I want to ask you is whether or not, assume for the sake of argument, that there was an equivocal invocation of the right to counsel and she should have been told. The information that comes afterwards, would you agree that what was elicited was more damning than what came before? The most damning statements came towards the end of the statement. Would you agree with that?
Most damaging statements, yes, but I would also note that this jury did acquit the defendant of aggravated assault, which was the higher charge, and instead opted to convict the defendant of the lesser included of simple assault. So the jury clearly wasn't prejudiced by all of the more graphic admissions that followed.
Are you arguing that if there was error, it was harmless?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Dr. Medina's testimony. was it beyond the ken of the jury for the expert to opine that the pulling, the tugging, et cetera, the twisting, the throwing was beyond normal caregiving?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't. The overall thrust of Medina's testimony is against this argument. It's impossible to know whether the jurors were familiar with caretaking or potential injuries which could result. Most people would know that infants are fragile.
Don't you need an expert for that if you're going to talk about caretaking? This doctor is not an expert on caretaking. If you're going to talk about standards, whether it's caretaking or anything else, you need an expert knowledge on those standards. This doctor could testify some mechanism of injury, the type of injury, extent of the injury, permanency, but he certainly couldn't testify as to standards of caretaking. And he certainly couldn't testify as the ultimate opinion that it was the defendant's negligence that caused it. He could say the manner of what supports pushing or shoving or whatever and mimic the defendant's words, but he cannot opine on the ultimate issue before the jury, can he?
Well, first,
does Rule 702 or 703 allow that?
To handle the first part of Your Honor's question, because I believe that's going to be the shorter answer. Dr. Medina was qualified as an expert in pediatrics and extensively discussed her qualifications, particularly regarding the care of children. And again, she testified as an expert in pediatrics with specialized knowledge in child abuse.
That's not standards of caretaking, is it? You generally don't do this when you're taking care of a child. You generally don't do that.
Well, it's indicative of what is or I would argue that abuse subsumes caretaking. What is improper caretaking is often analogous to abuse, and the ability to draw those fine distinctions is inherent to what she was qualified in.
Did I misunderstand your answer earlier? Please tell me if I did. This I'm reading from page 31 of the transcript where Dr. Medina says, so normal caregiving activity does not involve pulling, twisting, or of course, not throwing a child in that manner. Did the jury need an expert to tell them that normal caregiving, that throwing a child is beyond normal caregiving? Assume the expert was qualified. Is that appropriate expert testimony?
Well, I would argue first that, again, it goes to her, it's the entire testimony as a whole in this case that indicates that that is not something outside of the ken of the jury.
Say that again. Jurors do or do not understand that throwing a child
is not part of normal caregiving?
The issue is whether parents or jurors, et cetera, would know whether Tommy's specific injuries could have been incurred in the ordinary course or not. So I would argue that that testimony goes to that point, right? What is or is not in the ordinary course? You have to establish what the ordinary course is to begin with. And you do that by the bounds of it. Turning to Justice Fernandez-Vina's first point regarding the ultimate issue testimony, Medina didn't testify that the defendant was guilty, and she didn't testify that these injuries were intentionally inflicted. She testified that they were non-accidental and that they were consistent with what was described in the defendant's statement. As far as non-accidental goes, non-accidental subsumes a much larger scope of conduct than just intentional. So really, when she testifies that, she's not necessarily saying these were intentionally inflicted. For example,
could you explain the larger scope of non-intentional to me?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize, I just need one moment. So, again, I apologize, Your Honor. Merriam-Webster's dictionary specifically describes it as involving carelessness, right? Which goes to more recklessness than intentionality. So describing conduct as non-intentional goes beyond just non-accidental, rather, goes beyond whether it was intentional or not. In fact, it goes to a much larger scope of conduct, like carelessness, right? Whether this could have been done by dropping the child accidentally or not. So it does go beyond that. And again, I would...
And the expert testimony was that it was intentional, right?
No, the expert testimony was that it was non-accidental.
Non-accidental, which means essentially intentional. If it's not an accident, then you intended for something to happen, correct?
Again, the state would disagree with that. Again, the word accidental encompasses events which occur unexpectedly and by chance. And again, that's the Merriam-Webster dictionary.
If you throw somebody to the ground, it's expected that they're going to hit the ground, aren't they? It's expected that they may get injured. So I intentional means not accidental, not by chance. And well, wasn't that the ultimate issue in this case that your expert testified to?
Well, first, it also goes to whether the child was dropped inadvertently. There are other explanations for a broken leg than just that the child was thrown.
Inadvertent, carelessly, by accident, all subsets of the same concept. Intentional means thrown, and that's what the expert testified to, correct?
But again, that's not what the expert testified to. The expert never at any point testified that the injuries were intentional. The expert testified that the injuries were non-accidental. So
the expert, tell me if I'm mistaken, the expert specifically referred to the nanny causing the accidents. I'm looking at like 60, 30, and 31. The injuries, and I'm just, tell me if I'm mistaken about this, said the injury is consistent with trauma, then goes on and talks about the nanny while caring for the child. She had thrown the child, hit the child, pulled on the legs, and that fracture. At that particular point, the expert is speaking not as an expert, but basically as a credibility decider, is specifically talking about the nanny having committed all those acts. Is that the role of the expert?
Well, that's not really what that the import of that testimony was. The import of that testimony is that it was consistent with what defendant had described, not that the defendant had done it. And counsel for the defendant brought that out specifically on cross-examination. And this is 60-63-18. So in fairness, your opinion is really limited to the information you're given. And the answer provided by the caregivers to medical staff and investigators, yes. So her answer was very, very limited to the exact, whether it was consistent with what the defendant had described versus consistent with what the parents had described. It's not as to causation at all, it's as to consistency. I do want to briefly touch on the bolstering argument that defendant raised. Medina testified that whatever caused those injuries should have been reported by his caregivers. And in this case, there was no history of accidental trauma. That means something very, very specific. It means that caretakers report accidental injury, and because there was no accidental injury reported, there was no accidental injury. But she doesn't identify either Seth or Lisa. To the contrary, she specifically refers to caretakers, a concept which also incorporates the defendant. So far from bolstering, this really just referred to a simple fact.
Counsel, have a look at your notes and tell us if there's any other points you wanted to touch on. I think we have your argument.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I do want to just briefly discuss the mom's testimony, which did come up. This has never been raised before this court. The defendant had the opportunity to brief it, and the defendant did not brief issues regarding what Lisa testified to. So I would argue that it's waived, but there was also a limiting instruction read by the judge, and that's presumed to have been followed. And I do just want to touch on the bright line rule suggested by Amicus very briefly.
May I ask you a follow-up on the mother's testimony? The limiting instruction was that it wasn't offered for the truth. What was it offered for?
Specifically, it was offered to explain what the parents did next regarding whether to take the child to the hospital or not.
And isn't the appropriate
way to present that by asking, what did you do next, glossing over the damning information that came from DCPP?
I mean, first, that information didn't come from DCPMP. That came from what Khan testified to, and it goes to the effect the information had on them, specifically regarding exactly what to do next.
When the parents took the child to the hospital, they didn't have any information that the caregiver had done anything intentionally at that point. All they knew was that the child had fractures and was told to take the child to the hospital, correct?
I don't believe that's present in the record, specifically whether they knew or had any discussions regarding that.
Well, they were on Long Island. They went to a doctor on Long Island. They had x-rays taken there. The doctor said the child had a fracture, and then they went back to their guest house, and the doctor called and said, the child has another fracture, take the child to the hospital. And that's when they took the child to the hospital. They didn't know anything about the caregiver at that point having caused any injury. Am I correct about that?
I don't think they ever testified that they knew specifically, but they did know that the crib could not have caused their injuries and that they did not. I believe it's logical to assume that.
I'm only reason why I'm bringing that out, this goes to the Chief Justice's question. It goes to the so-called limiting instruction, and like, really, what good was it doing?
Well, the limiting instruction was taking away this thing from what she said. It was eliminating a hearsay issue regarding what the wife had testified to, because she testified to what Dr. Khan had told her.
The judge did not tell them to disregard the information. Judges told them, don't use it for the truth of the matter. You can still use it.
Well, it was limited to exactly what they could use it for, specifically regarding to explain what those witnesses did afterwards. So the limiting instruction limits it from the truth to explaining why they did what they did. The fact that it was said, not the fact that it was truthful. It was a truthful or reliable statement. If your honors have no further questions, that I do want to just briefly touch on the bright line rule that both amicus have proffered. As the ACDL's attorney mentioned, unspoken words do matter, and those unspoken words are evidenced by the totality of the circumstances. That test, it has a long and storied history in our law because it allows consideration of more than just the plain text. This court has never reduced the utterance or the invocation to a single word. It's always been broader than that. And I would ask this court affirm its jurisprudence as to the totality of the circumstances.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. McLean, did you want to offer a rebuttal?
I didn't touch on harm in my initial presentation, but I'm happy to rely on my brief unless your honors have questions about that.
Questions, anyone?
Okay.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel for the very fine presentations.